The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you to everyone for being here, in particular the students in my class. I'm Todd Miller. I'm a lawyer practicing here in Washington, D.C. with Baker & Miller, an antitrust boutique firm. And I'm delighted today to have with me two very fine, distinguished lawyers who are going to be talking to us about private remedies for antitrust wrongs. And what we mean by that is where private parties bring action against the defendant, someone who's violated the antitrust law, and they're seeking, generally speaking, we're going to be talking about damage actions, but they may also bring action to seek an injunction. So let me first start out by, I'm just thinking here of the order. Let me introduce my co-panelists here, and then what I'd like to do is to run through some of these slides just to set the framework. In terms of the format this morning, I'll sort of set the tone here that should take about 10 minutes or so, and I'm going to turn it over to Charles and to Thomas to speak for a bit, and then we'll have a few questions, and then we're hoping to have this very interactive, so I'm hoping you'll be prepared with lots of questions yourself. And so again, part of the purpose of this is to raise some issues for you to be thinking about and trying to get a comparative approach. So let me start by introducing our speakers. First, to my immediate left is Charles Whittington, a partner at Field Fisher Waterhouse in London. He's duly qualified as a solicitor in England and also as a lawyer in New York. Now, the thing that he's learned, he must be of good moral character because the London Bar, requires that. New York doesn't. So we're pleased to have him. He's the head of the EU and competition law group at Field Fisher Waterhouse. They have offices throughout Europe, and in fact, they have sort of exciting news. And we have Pierre, who in the audience, they are having a pretty significant expansion of their competition group that was just announced on Monday, wasn't it? Yesterday. So they will be more of a global powerhouse as of the near future. Over on the other side of Charles is Thomas Chabanis. I had to get the S in there. He is at Shook, Harding, and Bacon. Many of you may know him. He's on the adjunct faculty here as well. He teaches French law and sometimes legal writing. He is very much involved in litigation, particularly in the pharmaceutical area, and also he's obviously an expert in French law. So what they're going to speak about, Charles is going to be talking about the overall attempt to bring private actions into the European community generally. He'll also be speaking specifically about where we stand in terms of the UK and such actions. Thomas will be talking to us about France and the developments there in this regard, and then he'll also be addressing some of the interesting comparisons between common law and civil law jurisdictions. Okay, so with that, let me get moving here a little bit. Okay, when we look at the system of private remedies, we're really looking at three primary justifications for doing so. The first, and probably the most important, is simply compensating the victims for an antitrust wrong. So, for example, in a price-fixing case, the allegation is going to be that the price has gone up. Who's paid more for that? The customers or the defendants? And so, therefore, they deserve to be compensated for their loss. The second, and it might be called many different things, I've lumped a bunch of these under what deterrence, which is simply preventing this from happening again. So you have the ability to have the private action increases the likelihood of getting caught. Why? The customer is often the one who's going to be the first to be aware of activity that might be suspicious and thereby give rise to an antitrust type claim. Second, and this is something you'll see reflected in court decisions quite frequently, it's the increased cost of the bad act. You violated the law, you need to pay. And so, therefore, it's a benefit to have that increased deterrence. The third thing is that it increases the general awareness of competition law rules. Now, I believe that the commission staff puts this as a separate topic, from deterrence, when they talk about bringing competition law closer to the consumer. I've put it in there because, to me, it's part of the deterrence process. It's teaching people about competition law so we'll have fewer violations. And then lastly, private remedies can be a substitute for inadequate public resources where you don't have an active government that's fully funded to go after antitrust violations. Allowing individuals to bring such actions can be beneficial. We saw that at the sort of at the beginning of U.S. antitrust enforcement. The notion was that private plaintiffs would be miniature or private attorney generals who could then enforce the law. Okay. The other thing I just sort of want to give us is some categories to think about, and that is types of private action that you're going to see. The first and probably the most important category are follow-ons to governmental litigation. This is where you have the European Commission, obviously the U.S. Department of Justice, bringing an action against someone, then the victims can then bring a case afterwards. So I put under there a lot, of course, that's in the United States, a lot of those are brought as class actions. You also have, I've got sort of as a separate category under there, opt-out actions. And again, I'm just sort of trying to highlight issues. That's something that's being considered by the European Commission staff as they work on their white paper. Next are independent actions. You might see these as licensing disputes, sport league disputes. It can be almost anything that comes up. It could be an independent price fixing case where the government hasn't acted. It's not infrequent that the private plaintiffs actually move before the government actually does. My third category is competitor actions against alleged monopolist. Again, a very common category of case looking at private litigation in the United States. This is one you might put a little star by. The concern is that those kind of cases are particularly abused as a way to deter aggressive competition, bring a lawsuit, allege that the monopolist or the defendant has done something wrong, and thereby you slow them down a bit. And then last, we have to recognize the importance of arbitration. More and more of these disputes are getting handled through arbitration. Okay. In my next couple of slides, I've raised a number of distinguishing features, again, to sort of raise the policy debate here. The first category, broadly speaking, are the incentives for the plaintiffs to bring their lawsuit. And so I start out with multiple damages or the availability of punitive damages. As you would know, in the United States, for a successful antitrust plaintiff is entitled to three times their proven damages, so treble damages. That comes from the old English Statute of Monopolies from 1620, and Charles will be bringing us a little more up to date, I think, from that statute. The next is costs, and we have, and in this whole area, that may be one of the more important things. You've got the English versus American rule, and by that I mean the American rule is you pay for your own legal costs, period. So a successful defendant suffers their own costs, and that can be quite expensive. Under the English rule, it puts the burden on the plaintiff that if the plaintiff is not successful, then it owes the defendant his or her costs. And so that creates a disincentive to bring these lawsuits. Last is the availability of attorney's fees. Again, in these kinds of cases, it can be quite substantial in the millions of dollars. So it's interesting if it can be available for the successful plaintiff. And then last, and this is where I put in, the availability of injunctive type relief. Okay. In a second category, I've got other relief type considerations, and this gets maybe a little more technical in terms of what one might be doing in the private remedies. And so question one is about the availability of passing on. And what I mean by that, or what the courts would mean by that, is when the antitrust defendants have charged their customers a certain amount, the question becomes, have those customers then in turn raised their price to their own customers? So they haven't suffered any real damage because they simply charge more to their customers. So for example, in the vitamins litigation, where you have vitamins being a distinct component of many products, including, guess what, vitamins that consumers might use, if you sell vitamin C to a pill vitamin manufacturer, and they simply say, okay, my cost went from $1 to $1.50 for the vitamin C. Now when I make my tablets and resell them to consumers, I'll just charge them more, and therefore I haven't lost any real money. So can that be a defense to the action in that case? Because the defendant would say, no, they haven't suffered any loss, they've passed it all on. Next, and closely related to that, is indirect purchaser standing. So in the example I just gave, it'd be that it's the customer of the customer. Do they have the ability to bring a lawsuit? Next is joint and several liability. How are the defendants related to each other vis-a-vis the payment of damages? In the United States, you have joint and several liability, so a large defendant is usually a very attractive target because it may have to pay damages for the entire industry. And then last are rights of contribution, and that is the notion that if you have an unsuccessful defendant that ends up paying the entire bill for the industry, they can go against the other defendants and say, look, I paid for everything, you now owe me some money because you were also a guilty defendant and it's not fair for you to get off scot-free. In the U.S., there's absolutely no right of contribution, so that comes up as an important issue later on. Okay. Now, over here I have more, this is more about the technical aspects of bringing a lawsuit, again, to be thinking about pleading type requirements. In the U.S., of course, we have notice pleading and versus pleadings with more specificity. Just as a footnote, we have in front of the Supreme Court now the Bell Atlantic versus Twombly case, which is dealing with this very issue, where the Second Circuit has essentially said that a plaintiff bringing conspiracy kind of claim simply needs to give broad general notice of its claim. It doesn't need to have a lot of specifics in there. As long as the conspiracy is not implausible based on the facts alleged, then the complaint would survive a motion to dismiss. Here I also have the civil versus common law distinctions, which Thomas will talk about. Discovery rules are very important, vary tremendously around the world, so that's something to be looking at. Next is effects of and relation to governmental action. In some jurisdiction, a governmental action is required before a private action can be launched. Brazil would be an example of that. Next are burdens of proof. And I would throw in there also whether proof of fault is required. In the Ashurst study of the private actions in Europe, they noted that many jurisdictions in Europe require proof of fault, and then that would be above and beyond the proof of the antitrust or competition law violation, and that would create an additional hurdle for private plaintiffs to overcome. And last are the decision makers. Is there a specialized tribunal, as there is in the United Kingdom, or are you dealing with general commercial courts that may have no particular experience or expertise with competition law matters? Okay, so then I've thrown in as the modest U.S. government, or not government representative, but the U.S. representative on this panel, that here, as you probably know, in the U.S. we have notice pleading and very broad discovery rights, and so this leads it's an important aspect of litigation in the United States. It leads people ultimately to settle a lot of these cases, even if they believe they're not meritorious, simply because of the cost and expense of defending. Another area of concern created by the availability of private remedies would be legal confusion. With the competition law boom around the world and the heightened interest in private remedies, we may see more and more confusion. If you have several courts in any one jurisdiction issuing conflicting decisions about particular points of law along the way, you're going to have maybe a complete mess. And so that's a concern as people develop these kinds of systems. Okay, I also wanted to flag as one of the more important ways in which in the United States we've cut back on private remedies and having them overly available, and that is our antitrust injury requirement. The plaintiff must show that the harm alleged has come from the wrongful aspects of the antitrust violation. And so I've given you the famous Supreme Court case, the Brunswick versus Pueblo Bolomat, and in which the plaintiff's claim really flowed from competition aspects, and so the court ruled that they didn't have standing to pursue that in an antitrust court. They were saying we lost profits because this larger bowling alley system was going to lower price, and that court said, no, 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 that's just wrong. You're a competitor. That's competition's all about that, and so therefore you didn't suffer antitrust injury from this. Okay. Last, you can't sort of skip over this area without recognizing the international aspects of private remedies and the interdependence of the various jurisdictions. You've got a lot of cooperation among the jurisdictions, the antitrust enforcement authorities at the governmental level, and that's going to have some impact on private actions as well. And so we've got at the end there, the private litigation has traditionally gravitated to the United States and has over the years created tremendous international conflict, since many other jurisdictions don't like the fact that their companies are being subjected to treble damages, attorney fee actions in the United States, which they view as somewhat abusive and maybe contrary to their own public policy. So a couple years ago now, we have the relatively famous Empegrane case, in which the Supreme Court looked at these issues and said that a foreign plaintiff, cannot sue in a U.S. court for wholly foreign injury. Since then, that's tremendously cut back on some of the litigation in the United States, but has not completely eliminated it. There are still some open issues where the harm may be intertwined with what's going on in the U.S. So there's cases that are working their way through the lower courts about what are the limits, the proper limits of Empegrane. Okay, so we've got that. And we'll be hearing from Charles a bit maybe about tougher EC decisions, which may have, again, an effect on private actions as the European Commission gets more active and prohibits more things with clearer reasoning. You may see more interest in follow-on actions on those matters. Okay, so my conclusion, it's obviously private litigation is a very important part of the U.S. scheme of enforcement of our antitrust law. It's becoming more and more important around the world. It's reflected in part by the Green Paper in the European Commission. We have a lot of difficult issues, which I'm going to turn to my panelists to take us through at least some of those. And you know, we can sort of use the U.S. as a cautionary tale in this regard. There are a couple things. I will close by noting that there's a lot of materials out there of interest. One very good paper is the Asher study that was done now a couple years ago, August of 2004, where they did a comparative study of the state of private remedies availability within the European Union. In addition, there's a working group of the International Competition Network that's looked at this, and they sent out a questionnaire to a number of countries, and I think they had their publication in May of last year, in which they came out with some preliminary conclusions, which I think you'll find are consistent with a lot of the things we'll be seeing today. So with that maybe long-winded wind-up, I'm going to turn it to Charles and let him tell us about Europe.
Okay. Thanks, Todd. I don't think I need a microphone. If you can't hear me, then just waggle.
Do you want to stand up here?
Should I stand up there?
I'm just going to get this.
I think in the European context, what I should try to do is perhaps set the scene in terms of why the European Commission in particular has been looking at private remedies. In the European context, we had a logjam with a kind of big bang expansion with the accession of a bunch of new member states, not the most recent ones, Bulgaria and Romania, but the ones that came before, Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic and so on. And the Commission realized that it was going to have to prioritize its resources, and it wasn't going to be able to deal with notifications, so it did away with the ability to go to the European Commission and seek clearance of agreements. And they realized that they were going to have to, within their resources in the Commission, that where they were going to prioritize, one of the areas of priority was going to be dealing with cartels. And so they have a separate EC team within the Commission to deal specifically with cartels. And we also had a new regulation called Regulation 1 of 2003, which set out the scope of powers for member states The short of it being that national regulatory authorities and national courts were empowered to apply Article 81 and 82 directly, and where there was an actual potential material effect on trade between member states, national authorities and courts were required to apply Article 81 or Article 82 first in priority to any national law that might be in force. However, the Commission doesn't have the power to award damages to private parties for antitrust injury. And since they're sharing responsibility with the national regulatory authorities, including the clearance provisions in Article 81.3, which is to do with restrictive agreements, the Commission started an initiative to see how they could encourage and foster private remedies in private parties to seek remedies for damage suffered from antitrust infringements. As Todd said, there is there's an ECN competition network there's an international one, and there's also one within Europe, which enables the European Commission and the national regulatory authorities to talk to each other and to work out common approaches to cross-border infringements and prioritise actions to be taken in respect to specific infringements. The picture in Europe as far as private judgments for damages for antitrust injury is pretty woeful. One of my colleagues did a search and found there have been 68 actions in Europe and not one single award of damages. So that's a pretty sorry state of affairs. And although the Commission has been pretty active in prosecuting cartels and in dealing with infringements of Article 82, we haven't seen any of these fines that they've imposed resulting in damages awards from national courts, which is not to say that there haven't been actions, it's not to say that there haven't been payments, there have been a number of settlements, including the vitamins case, but we haven't seen any judgments. The nearest we came, I think, was in the UK, out of a long-running saga involving a battle with a publican, what's called Courage and Crean case, where Crean was a publican who had two pubs, which were subject to a beer tie, and he went bankrupt. And he alleged that the reason he went bankrupt was because he was subject to a tie which required him to pay over the odds for the beer that he got from the brewer Courage, and alleged there was a breach of Article 81. And it went to the ECJ a couple of times, it went to the Court of Appeals a couple of times, and ultimately it went back to the trial judge to rule on whether or not there had been an effect on trade between the states. And he said that although there was some causation between the tie and him going bankrupt, there was no effect on trade between member states, and therefore no infringement of Article 81, and therefore the damages award was non-existent. So he lost, and that is the nearest that we've come in the UK. There are one or two cases floating around in Europe. There's one going on in Germany at the moment, I think two or three in France, but we're pretty much behind the eight ball compared to the states. And so the Commission published this, the Green Paper, in which it looked at try to identify what the stumbling blocks were to successful private damages remedies being pursued, and it identified about seven or eight key factors. The most important one, or at least the one that was identified by those whom it sent that responded to this questionnaire, was the access to evidence. That was seen as the number one issue by practitioners. And we've got issues about business secrets in Europe, which, of course, in normal discovery, business secrets wouldn't be a basis for withholding evidence. But we'll come on to talking about evidence and how that's gleaned. The notice pleadings that you have in the States, we don't have that in the UK. The position in the UK is a bit different from the position on the continent. We have a fact pleading basis, but it means that plaintiffs are not more able to go on what you would class as a fishing expedition in terms of dredging up evidence that they can use. So access to evidence is a key one. Another one is this issue of fault that Todd referred to. We don't, in the UK, have a requirement to prove fault. There was a case called Garden Cottages, which was quite a long time ago now, in which the question arose as to what is an 81-82 infringement, what kind of a creature is it? And it's been classed as a statutory duty, as a tort, to infringe after 81. And as a tort, all you've got to do is prove the elements that comprise the infringement of the tort, and there's no additional hurdle to show fault. So we don't have a fault threshold, so that's not an impediment for us in the UK. Damages is another issue which is identified as one of the big stumbling blocks in terms of how you calculate damages, whether you have purely compensatory or whether we go for a multiple damages situation like you have in the States. I think there's a tremendous resistance to the idea of having multiple damages and sort of automaticity to in introducing a kind of punitive element, because in the UK we have the concept that damages essentially are intended to be compensatory. So you're compensating the injured party for the wrong that they've suffered. And in Anglo-Saxon terms, in the idea of tort, what you're seeking to do is to put the party into the position it would have been if the tort of the wrong had not been committed. So it's entirely driven as a compensatory structure. We did have a battle in the airline sectors many years ago involving Laker, Freddie Laker, and his first attempt at deregulated airlines. And Pierre, my colleague here, is an expert on airlines. But in that, there was a fear that there was going to be a antitrust damage award imposed on British Airways and others, which would have resulted in a treble damages award. And so they introduced, ad libbing here, is the Protection of Trading Interests Act 1972, I think, which prohibited a party, an individual, an undertaking from paying treble damages if they were imposed in the UK. And that was deployed specifically by the government of the day because they were so opposed to the idea of multiple damages being introduced. So there is, that's an issue in Europe, and I would be surprised if we see the multiple damages being introduced as a kind of an automatic source of relief. The fourth area that the Commission identified in its green paper was this issue of the passing on defence, which Todd has explained. And there's an interesting conundrum there, I think, which you had, was it the Hoover case? The one that said Hanover. We have a principle that the European Court of Justice has articulated recently in the Manfredi case, with the idea that there is a principle of effectiveness under the European Treaty, and that those who are injured must be able to get an effective remedy, there must be an effective redress for them. And by the same token, the party which has committed the wrong shouldn't be seen to have unjustly enriched itself from its anti-competitive conduct. So how do you balance the requirement for effective redress against the public policy idea that there shouldn't be unjust enrichment? And it sort of comes together in the question of the passing on defence, because downstream customers, the direct customer of the cartel participants, in a sense suffered loss because they had to pay a higher price, but then if they passed that on, then the causation goes away, because in the UK you have to show a causal link between the antitrust infringement and the damages that have been suffered. So in terms of compensation, there isn't any compensation to pay, arguably, because they've passed it on. So that is an issue which has been identified, and that is completely unresolved and opened at this stage, as to whether indirect purchasers should have standing. Representative actions is another issue that they've identified. In the UK, we do have the idea of representative actions. In fact, we've got a number of different possibilities. You can have a representative action where you join in all of those, that they all join in alongside you, but you are then affected by anything that happens to the named party. So you have one named plaintiff with a whole string of other parties sitting behind them. But if there's a statute of limitations issue or if there's a causation issue, you are all equally affected by that. I guess there's an analogy in intellectual property where you have a community trademark and you don't have national ones, and if you lose on one, you lose all the others. It's the same sort of idea. In the UK, we can have a representative body, and we've got the Consumers Association, which has been certified by the Secretary of State as being empowered to take actions on behalf of consumers in the UK who have suffered loss. And we've got a very recent example, a live one, it's just started, where the consumer body, which is called WHICH, has now instituted proceedings against the suppliers of replica soccer football shirts. And they had to wait, and this is a point I think Todd wanted to be drawn out, is at what point do you bring proceedings? In the UK, if you could start proceedings at any time, but if the administrative procedure is still ongoing, then the court would stay the private damages action until after all of the processes involved in the administrative action have been exhausted. So there would be a finding of infringement by the European Commission or by, in the UK, by the OFT. That is then subject to blessing to appeal, and they have the right to take that to the Competition Appeal Tribunal, and then ultimately to the High Court and the Court of Appeal. So all of that process would have to be exhausted before the private damages action could continue. In the replica football shirts case, those remedies, those rights of appeal have now been exhausted. The time limit for filing an appeal has passed, and within a week after that happening, WHICH launched its private damages action on behalf of all consumers. So that's permitted. And we've got one or two other sort of nuanced representative actions which are possible. Cost recovery, Todd mentioned. In the UK, there is a principle that costs follow the event. So as a general principle, if you are a plaintiff suing for antitrust infringement and you lose, you will be responsible for the other side's costs, including attorney's fees. Now, that's not 100%. That would simply, of course, recognize that would simply be an opportunity for the successful party to require a blank check to be written. So the costs are what we call tax, which means they're subject to assessment, which creates a whole separate little area of expertise for people who are expert in looking at costs and saying whether or not the attorney's hourly rate was a reasonable one, whether there were too many experienced people on the job and all that sort of stuff. But the rule of thumb is if you get about 70%. I recently had a strikeout action on behalf of an alleged monopolist who was sued by a well-known English newspaper proprietor and editor. And we struck out the case, and we had our attorney's fees paid, and we recovered about 75% of our fees, including experts, etc., from the losing party, and the rest we got from insurance because they had insurance. So they were made whole, and they were very, very content. That basic rule is subject to some more nuanced interpretation because there have been cases where cartelists have appealed against the final infringement by the Office for Trading, and in the Competition Appeal Tribunal, they have lost, and in principle they would be subject to paying the Office for Trading's costs, but because they were small enterprises, the CAT exercised its discretion not to award costs. And so although they were infringers and had appealed and lost, they didn't have to pay the OFT's attorney's fees, and that was a public policy decision. So I guess the lesson that one takes from that is that there's no automatic right as of law to costs. It's a principle, but the court has a discretion. So when you win or lose in a case, that is always then immediately followed before the gavel comes down by an application to the judge for costs, and that may be adjourned to a separate hearing and so on. But generally, costs follow the event. The last major topic, you didn't give me a deadline as to how long I could talk for, but two more minutes, thank you. That was the right answer. The last big topic that the Commission identified was the need for coordination between public and private sector, because although they want to encourage private damages actions, and Todd identified some of the reasons for that in terms of husbanding resources and greater effectiveness of working in competition, equally, private damages actions shouldn't get in the way of the public law responsibilities for enforcing competition law. And so issues of, for example, leniency, how should a court deal with private damages, those seeking private damages against cartelists who have secured leniency, may have settled with their customers? Should there be discretion exercised by the judicial body in terms of award of damages between amongst co-conspirators and so on? Those sorts of issues are very important. Access to evidence in terms of the evidence that is provided by the leniency applicant, should that be available to everyone? Those are the sorts of things which the Commission is concerned about, which are perfectly legitimate. And I guess in closing, I'd just say that the European Court of Justice has demonstrated, when it's been asked to review cases involving these sorts of issues, they have reaffirmed the importance of access to justice, the ability to seek redress, and so on. But the Court of Justice's interventions is intermittent because of necessity. By the time it gets to the ECJ, it could be several years after the infringement. It could be very slow. And so the Commission's initiative is to try and find a way of encouraging private damage action while preserving the public law responsibility it has to enforce, to act as the policeman for the enforcement of Article 3182. And I'm sure there'll be lots of opportunities to take this further. Thanks, Tom.
I'm going to try to follow a little bit the point that Todd and, brought up to our attention. I think one of the main thing is, you know, when you listen to our U.S. colleague and think about what you can do in the U.S. and how private actors really have a role in getting damages for something that happened to them in this area, and you're on the French or a civil law perspective, and you're like, had never heard such things. It's just, we don't even run statistics on how many antitrust cases you have in Europe or in France. It's something that we don't talk about just because we have the governments taking care of us. And I think that's the main point. It's, you've got the civil law system where the government is going to take care of you versus the common law system where you've got to get involved. And I think that's the main difference. And everything comes down from there. And recently, I mean, the EU is pushing, member states to go for a different system and try to involve the citizens and the companies that are involved in some wrong or the victims of the wrong, and it will I think it will take a huge change of mentalities in Europe to get there. I think a good place to start here is just jurisdictions and. In 2001, the French Parliament decided that maybe we needed to get a little bit more private enforcement, and it was very reluctant to go there, but they decided to do so. And the Parliament passed this law that would allow certain jurisdictions to be more specialized in handling those antitrust matters. And at the end of the day, it took 5 years for the government to actually pass a decree that would, implement that law. 5 years where people were raising questions and all that. And at the end of the day, now we have specialized jurisdictions and actually lawyers that now know how to handle those cases. But for many years, judges would have one antitrust case in their entire tenure, and they just didn't know how to approach them. Now we have only, I mean, the way it works is really you have four courts. You have, if the matter is between two, I guess, people who are in the trade of business, they will go in front of a commercial court, Tribunal de Commerce. And if they're more involved if there is a private party that has nothing to do with the consumer or something like that, then they will go before the general jurisdiction. Now you basically have four specialized courts in the country, both on the commercial side and the general side, that will basically take care of those matters. And now the judges are being educated in those matters. However, our system is so different that even with all the education that we're taking all those cases, the jurisdictions are still fairly inefficient in handling those matters. Basically, the way it works, you have three ways to go about getting remedies for some antitrust action. And the first one is just go to court, and it's a standalone action, and you hope you win. It's probably the fastest way to go. The second way is start with a complaint with the government authority, the Conseil de la Concurrence, and hope that your case will be solved within the next 10 years. And then the third way is go with the private action, and then go to the Conseil de la Concurrence, and then ask them to help the court and provide in the form of an amicus brief or amicus curiae system, provide the court with some assistance. We've talked about a few issues here earlier, and one of them is discovery, and discovery is extremely important. And when you're a civil law lawyer, you understand the concept of getting documents, maybe 20 of them at the end of the day, and you're fine with that. However, antitrust actions require that you have an extensive look at what the other party was doing, and unfortunately, our current system does not allow the plaintiff to do so. That's where getting the Conseil de la Concurrence involved in your action is extremely important. Basically, if you think that there is a fraud, then you might have a criminal aspect to your action, and then some kind of discovery is possible. However, proving fraud is extremely, extremely difficult. And so most of the cases are just you believe that there is some kind you have a damage, you know that some kind of behavior by the defendant is the cause of your damage, and just like in England we have to prove causation. However, that's not enough to launch a criminal inquiry, and that's where you will need the Conseil de la Concurrence to intervene. So that's definitely a big issue, and that's why you have so few cases that are filed in France, just because at the end of the day it's really, really hard to make your case. The second thing is, and we've talked about it a little bit earlier, it's costs. in France, if you spend a few $100,000 on your attorney's fees, you think that's actually a lot. Here, if you spend a few $100,000 a month, for a lot of companies, it's all right. And that's a huge. There is a huge disincentive. I mean, it's just lawyers do not do the type of work that they do in common law countries, or going through the documents and getting to know your case. It's all about the legal merits of the case, and those the antitrust cases are very fact intensive cases, and you need to understand what was going on, and only. Only that is the government has the manpower to go through this process. Lawyers are not allowed to deduct success fees for the 33% that you will get in the U.S. Because of that, you have to be really sure that your case is really good, and those are very hard cases to make. So that's why. In many cases, you let the Conseil de la Concurrence go first, and eventually you will have a follow-on action. Another big issue, and I think we've talked a little bit about the follow-on principle. In France, the findings of the Conseil de la Concurrence are not binding to the courts. And that's extremely damaging for private actions. If you have to prove your case all over again in front of the court, when basically the Conseil de la Concurrence took 5 years or 10 years to figure out that case, you're facing a huge hurdle. Recently, the Conseil de la Concurrence and the Cour de Cassation, which is the Supreme Court of France, actually proposed that the Conseil de la Concurrence findings were become binding on the courts. Most people want that to happen, but it's not happening, not yet. So the costs in attorney's fees for those actions are a lot. At the end of the day, the courts are willing to grant certain cost to the plaintiff if they win their action. However, we were talking about 70% earlier in England being the norm. It's 70% of what? In France, 70% of $1 million, $2 million is a lot for a judge to decide to grant 70% of that amount. And that's really what it takes at the end of the day. That's how much it takes to litigate those cases. So if you had this binding rule from the Conseil de la Concurrence, that would probably help a lot. Also, here, a lot of antitrust cases are class actions for consumers. And France doesn't have, and most civil law countries don't have the class action principle, and that's basically hurting this type of cases a lot. We recently had a change in that area where you actually can have consumer protection groups acting as a representative cases, and it's great. However, those consumer groups are not allowed to recruit the consumers to basically seek the damages. So, I was recently going through the there was a big case against France Telecom, who's the telecom operator in France, the market there. again, they charged for many years a $5 or like I think actually it was 5 francs per month on everyone's bills. And the consumer protection group that sued them and seeking private remedies were really happy that they had 11,000 people joining their class action. And you're like, every single person in France had that issue. It's just, they're not allowed to send you that old letter that you will receive about every 2 years in the US saying, do you want to join my class action? It's just they can't do that. So at the end of the day, yes, it's a lot of money, and we're finally getting there in terms of damages, where it's a lot of money that France Telecom had to pay for both the private action and the government action. But as long as, if you don't get people involved in this process, you're not going to get anywhere. And I think the mentality is not there yet. Take years to eventually get a class action model in the European country or in civil law countries. I think that comes back to the first thing I said, which is basically we or civil law countries expect the government to take care of you. But because of that, it has to have those powers that private people don't have, and it will take years to get there. We were talking a little bit about discovery a little earlier, and I think another issue with discovery in France is this is not what you companies are not supposed to look at each other's documents. This is not the way it's supposed to be, and it's just a mentality thing. And it's true because of years and or centuries of traditions, and when you read the Green Paper, it is probably making sense everywhere to apply some of the recommendations. It will just take a lot of time to happen. Also, the other thing is, the recommendation that the Green Paper is making would have such an impact on the rest of the law. If you start introducing class actions for one thing, why not have product liability cases with class actions? And that's just you're changing the landscape completely. If you're talking about giving an incentive to lawyers in bringing those cases to you're talking about success fees, and that's just not the way we gentlemen do it in French courts, and I think you would have you would have more than a change in law, you have to have a change in mentality to achieve these goals. I think they're extremely respectable, but I have some doubts as to whether the French system can achieve it. I think,
stay there for one second. If I could just ask you a question, and I'll ask the same question of Charles in a moment, but in the U.S., a lot of these cases are brought largely because of lawyers. So you have in these big class action cases, the lawyers are the ones driving it, not so much the victims. It seems to me that the lawyers, notwithstanding the hurdles that you face in the jurisdiction, with lack of binding follow-on actions, problems with class actions, et cetera, the lawyers still have an interest in bringing cases if they can, and pursuing those, and maybe ultimately hoping for the pot of gold at the end. I mean, is that just not the way French lawyers think of the world? Are they not quite as entrepreneurial, perhaps, as U.S. lawyers? How would you see that as a difference?
think the main difference is the number of lawyers. When I sat for the New York bar, there were 10,000 people in that room. In Paris, there are 20,000 attorneys. So every year, New York creates as many lawyers, or in 2 years, New York creates as many lawyers as Paris has created in 50 years. So I think the incentive to, I mean, lawyers are busy, or they have things to do. Or most of them. And they just don't want to, I guess, they also see themselves as part of the old society and part of we have a lot of respect for ethics and that kind of thing. And I don't think they see themselves as going into that profession to make money. It's, you're assisting the courts. And that's your role is. Some lawyers would like to do it, and actually, I truly believe that a lot of lawyers are already doing it. They just won't tell you. I don't think that the majority of the lawyers really care for that kind of cases. I think they will take them if they like consumer protection group is there to help them and they will do it more in a noble way or for a noble goal than actually for the money and I think that's a fairly big difference. And at the end of the day, I think also that a lot of lawyers really love the way the French system is or the civil law system, and they're not very happy with all the common law influence, and that is really a huge roadblock. And even if they would benefit from it, I don't think that they see it that way.
Charles, can I ask you the same question?
Sure. Well, as far as the number of lawyers are concerned, when I took the New York Bar exam, I was the 13th English lawyer to qualify in New York. That was in 1984, and at that time there were 54,000 restaurants in New York, and there were more restaurants in New York than there are lawyers then in England. Not sure that means anything.
There's a lot of sheep in New Zealand too.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there are a number of factors that play out, at least in the UK. I think in the US you have the ability to launch class actions where people have to opt out of the class. We don't have that in the UK. You have to join in. We don't have treble damages. So that doesn't have the attractive force. We abandoned it as being unfair. Yeah. It's inconsistent with the compensatory principle. We do have exemplary damages, which is the ability of the courts to award damages. Well, we've got exemplary damages and we've got aggravated damages. Aggravated damages is basically a form of compensatory award. You're still going for sort of compensation of the victim. Exemplary damages is damages awarded above and beyond the compensation principle where the perpetrator has behaved in a particularly deliberate fashion of deliberately ignoring or seeking to make profit out of an illegality that they're aware of. And it seems to me that that is going to be a territory which is ripe for argument in the event, and we will eventually have a successful action for damages for infringement of either bid rigging regulations or just general cartel price fixing. I think that is an area where the court may be sympathetic to an argument that along the lines of effective redress and not allowing undue enrichment of the perpetrators, particularly if they're recidivists. We've had, and I don't know if you've had cement cartel cases over here, but cement lends itself to cartelization because the value of the market value of cement relative to the cost of transportation means that you're going to have smaller areas of effective competition around the factories that make the stuff. So it's lent itself to cartels. Yeah.
Maybe one comment, there is also another factor, which is the churches. Actually, the churches in France or in Belgium or in Germany are civil servants. They're not well paid. So if you take your example, you have the recovery of about 70% of 2 million euros. It's basically what the church will earn on this whole career, or two careers, which is totally different from the UK where they are well paid, and in the US where they usually shift in politics to cause. And this is maybe something that could explain why judges in continental Europe are really different to the world.
I think it's a very interesting point. There's another factor, and that is that competition law is generally viewed as a particularly complicated area of law, and complicated translates into risk, and that translates into high fees. And if in as in the UK, you have this principle of costs of following the event, you've got to be pretty sure that you've got a slam dunk case before you're going to launch a private damages action. And there are two different types, and we sort of melded them together, but a large number of these cases would be, in Fort Majesty's case that I referred to, we're talking about an increase in the cost to the consumer of a number of dollars per item, per shirt that they buy. And they're not going to launch a private damages action for $25-$30, which is where the consumer association comes in. So you've got those kind of representative type of actions. And then you've got the bid rigging on major construction projects, or the recent billion euro fine for price fixing on elevators and escalators, where those are clearly real estate investment funds, developers, they're the people who are commissioned, affected by those types of situations, where there might be a greater appetite for those types of cases. I think there are some practical differences, obvious differences between the North America and the continent of the UK, which have some rational differences.
Well, again, I guess what I was getting at a little bit is the notion that lawyers, we all compete for business.
Yeah.
And it would seem to me, and it's no secret that U.S. law firms are setting up in Europe, and particularly in London, to get ready for more aggressive private actions in your courts. And so, where you hear these stories about the difficulty of bringing actions and ultimately winning, it still seems to me that a lawyer who wants to be a little bit creative, who might not be as busy as many of your colleagues from Paris Bar, would say, you know what, I'm willing to take a shot at this because I have, for example, a ruling from the competition authority in some form that maybe it's not binding in France, but it certainly is a roadmap. Or in the UK, this is where you get into your pleading requirements. We have all these cartel investigations going on all the time, and there's information about those in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why in the US, literally one day after any kind of press release, that there might be a cartel, that there's going to subpoena, boom, you'll have a private action. Why is it bothered by that? And this is really getting to my point, it's lawyer competition.
You couldn't do that in the UK.
Yeah, in France. In most European countries, I think lawyers are not supposed to solicit any business.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think when I first joined the firm where I am now, which was about 13, 14 years ago, they didn't do any marketing. They didn't believe in marketing. Clients were loyal. Both of those are now unheard of as principles today. So in the UK, we've moved a very long way. There's no race to the courtroom or race to the bottom of the pit for plaintiff's attorneys in the UK, because you can't start your action unless you've got an actual client. You can't do this opt-out stuff where you launch a class action without any clients on the basis that they'll come along and solicit them.
What about the concern?
There is no doubt that there is. I mean, I can understand exactly why American firms are specializing in this, coming to open offices, particularly in the UK. I think the Courage and Crean case was an eye-opener, because the barrister on that case was a man called Mark Greeley, who is now QC, is now a Silk. And this is slightly anecdotal, but there's a point to it. Courage and Crean were both, they were parties to this tied lease agreement. If the tied lease agreement infringed Article 81, then they were parties to an illegal agreement. And as a matter of English law, a party to an illegal agreement can't rely on his or her own illegality and claim damages for infringement of that, the way that agreement infringes as a breach of statutory duty. And therefore, under, as a matter of old common law principle, that that plaintiff, Crean, was barred, as a matter of estoppel, from recovering for that illegality, notwithstanding the unequal bargaining position between them. Mark Greeley sat on a beach on holiday and read a bunch of US Supreme Court cases, as no doubt we all do. And he came across the case, the US Supreme Court case, which eludes me at the moment, Illinois Brick, which said that where there's an unequal bargaining power between parties to an illegal agreement, then that should not be, that equitable estoppel principle didn't necessarily always have to apply. And he cited that that case when the case was referred to the European Court of Justice. And the Court of Justice said, laid down some principles, but they took that principle up. There was an amicus filed by the UK government in support of Crean against the equitable estoppel principle. And that has now come back into the UK courts, and so we now recognise the ability of a party to an illegal agreement where they were in unequal bargaining positions to have the possibility of recovering damages. And the point of the story is that an American law firm, which is well skilled in dealing with the issues that you've been facing for many years on passing on defense and so on, and damages and discovery, although the local rules may be different, there may be some principles that have come out of the US Supreme Court which they can deploy in national proceedings in the UK. And yes, it may be 10 years to have a particular case work its way through to the European Court of Justice, but the principle of effectiveness, which is enshrined in the European Treaty, in which the European Court of Justice is not shy to deploy, is something that must be given effect to by the national member states in introducing rules that provide effective relief for injured parties to antitrust principles, is one which will follow through. So I'm not surprised to see American firms coming to the UK, and perhaps it's a lesson for us to take from.
Yeah. Does anyone out there have any questions?
I was wondering what you thought about project introduce
the
class action at the European level?
This is actually, I've just got a press release here, which I brought with me, which is from the consumer part of the European Commission. And that's caused quite some consternation. I think it's a good thing. I'm not quite sure how it's going to work its way through. But the idea is that consumers' associations from across the European Union will be able to join together to bring actions on behalf of all affected consumers. And right now, national courts only have the ability to award damages with respect to plaintiffs who have, where there's a causal link between the infringement and the injury suffered by that plaintiff. And the court needs to have asserted jurisdiction over the defendant in respect of that plaintiff. And in antitrust terms, in the UK, we had the Provini case, which was a spin-up from the Vitamins case, where there were third-party defendants who were suppliers to third plaintiffs who were outside the UK, so that the purchases occurred by plaintiffs outside the UK from defendant suppliers outside the UK. And the only nexus, the only connection with the UK, was the fact that the defendant suppliers were part of an undertaking, which is a European competition law concept which you're probably familiar with, and the UK court had approved using that interpretation of an undertaking in its application of jurisdictional assertion. And so, taking that analogy, I don't think it's, I think it's likely that we will ultimately have the ability consumers associations to join together for the purpose of seeking redress for injured consumers. The reference here is the supply of flawed products and services, I'm sure there are flaws, but they're double consumer relief in relation to that type of action rather than antitrust relief. And they're talking about where the consumers have been maliciously misled. So it's quite a malicious is quite a strong threshold. It's not the talk that I was talking about before. It implies some kind of conscious and willful ignoring of the quality of the products and services. But I wouldn't be surprised to see that. And that would be a stepping stone running in parallel with sort of the reason I brought it, because it seems to me that there is some resonance with things we're talking about today.
Yes.
I guess more of a general question for Paul or any of you. And in the U.S., we really seem to have a culture of litigation. And so it's not a surprise that we do have that private actions work well and that we do have private damages. And what I'm wondering is both in the U.K., which is a commonwealth system, but at the same time might have some structural differences, and then also on the continent, which for the most part, you have a civil law system, whether it's the structural changes that will encourage people to bring more private actions, or whether you need to have this cultural development in order for that to happen. And I think it's sort of a chicken and the egg type problem, but I was just wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, I think as far as the UK is concerned, I think we're going to need some structural oomph to kind of get people going, because we've had the ability, in the 1998 Competition Act introduced the ability to bring representative actions down. Admittedly, we're only about 6 years since the Act came into force, so it's taken a while for some cases to work their way through. But we haven't, well, I'm sure there have been some pro bono settled with substantial compensation being paid, apparently. But I think that we will need some structural things. I think that litigators will find their hands rather kind of loose by their sides, because we, through these reforms, which we refer to as the Wolf reforms after the previous Senate appeal, which was really disincentivizing people to go to trial. So unlike the continent, where you don't exchange a great mass of documents and you kind of get to the court, and probably here as well, Wolf said, we're not interested in this poker game because it's very inefficient for the administration of justice with the courts. We want to clear our dockets. We want to have people understand each other's position at a much earlier stage. And so they've introduced, in addition to the standard discovery that you would be familiar with, we've introduced this idea of pre-action discovery. The pre-action discovery enables a party, before they've even issued the complaint, to get an order from the court where they can satisfy the court that they're going to be a party, the target of the request is going to be a party, and that it's in the interest of justice, and so on, to request production of documents that are relevant to the case that they're threatening to bring. And strikeout case that I gave an example of, we went through a year of pre-action discovery before the action was commenced, including we voluntarily produced a witness statement strike application in the event that it commenced. And the whole purpose of that is to encourage the exchange of documents and evidence well in advance, so the parties can see where they stand, they can understand the likelihood, and there's a consequence for costs. And costs, the whole issue of costs, which for us means attorney's costs, not just out-of-pocket expenses, because attorney's fees for a client are out-of-pocket. Is interwoven, so if you refuse to produce or you refuse to accept a fact as a proven fact for the purpose of the case, and then that has to be proven and you lose, you pay the cost of proving that. So there are lots of kind of nuanced consequences to this. But we produced dozens and dozens of boxes of documents, which is tiny compared to antitrust cases over here. But I think that means that there are fewer trials coming through. There are more, much greater numbers of settlements, so litigators are losing. We do have the ability to get enhanced costs.
costs. We don't have treble damages, but lawyers can get 100% uplift if they have a pre-agreement for their client. We have a master account, and they work on effectively the continuous services through their field case, and there's an opportunity for about 5% uplift in the fees. So, treble damages.
Some question. Because even if you have the structural changes, you will still have to change the mentality of the plaintiffs. Companies are not happy to go to you or they don't like the fight. As we've seen, it's not very expensive to go to court. It's just it doesn't look good. It's bad publicity, Most companies would much rather settle out of court. In most cases, if you really have a big issue where a company, a plaintiff, lost a lot of money, they're probably out of business. Consumers are not educated about their rights. So even if you had all the structural changes that are needed to have a real meaningful private enforcement, you would still have to have people willing to go for it. I think some consumer associations are already starting to get there, but in terms of corporations going after each other, I think you still have to change mentalities a lot, and that we're not there yet. So I think you would have to move simultaneously on the structural side and on the mentality side.
Yeah. India will also face this problem because consumer is not like to go with litigation. We start the open court, India system is very slow. Success in the court is very difficult. So we start consumer forums. They are not formal, not total formal court. Consumer can go directly and can go with the help of the provider. Consumer forums are the try to solve this problem some informal way. If the company is not agree, then they give a decision. The decision is more like a poll. So, we also establish some consumer organizations, every state level, district level, to encourage the consumers to start the against cases against the company. So you get success. Consumer forums are more successful than both. But they can work informal, also formal both. I think that's the separate structure, separate forum, the success in consumer forums.
What about American corporations doing business in Europe? I mean, they're not afraid to sue each other. I was thinking of the Microsoft case. That was the European Commission. What was the standing of Netscape in that? Did they have any private right to intervene in that case, or were they just a bystander in that situation?
The Commission investigation was an administrative process, and so Netscape would have had, and did have the opportunity to respond to a question answering the Commission, to put in its operations, to meet with the investigation team, and make its position known, and indeed a number of representative bodies, the software Users Association in the UK, they filed a brief with the Commission. Then what happens is when the Commission reaches its decision, and Microsoft then appealed, then parties who have an interest would file a request with the appellate body, which in this case would be the first instance of the first stage of appeal, for standing. And if they can show that they're directly affected by the decision of the Commission, so to give you an example, in the brewing section, because I represented Whitbread, which was viewed as the case model that was cited in the Courage and Korean case. So I have a particular interest in what was going on in that case. I negotiated a clearance of the whole of Whitbread's time estate with the European Commission, which then used that as the financial model to apply to other brewers that came along. And we got our exemption from the Commission, and then a group of publicans who were tenants of Whitbread challenged that exemption, and they went to the Court of First Instance to challenge the Commission's clearance.
Is it a national court?
No, Court of First Instance, the European Court. The decisions of the Commission are appealed to the Court of First Instance, and then to the European Court of Justice as the ultimate, your Supreme Court. And you can get to that same court if you've got a case going on in the national court, and an issue of European law comes up about the interpretation of the treaty, then the parties can say to the court, we think there's a principle of European law which would override national law, and here are the questions, and the court agrees. They then suspend the proceedings in the national court, send the questions to the European Court of Justice, which then answers them, and then it goes back. And that's what happened in the Courage and Priam. They kept having these questions of European law, like back and forth. We applied, along with Whitbread, to the Court of First Instance for leave to appear as an interested party in that challenge, because we were directly affected if the publicans succeeded in overturning the Commission. So that's what happened, that's how it works. So the Commission, the Microsoft case is, no one's going to see us out, but it's kind of gently working its way through the European appeal press at the moment, and there will be parties that have Microsoft appealed and more by the second individual, which have kind of got permission, got leave to appear as interested parties in that European process.
But just maybe a little more directly on the example you gave, Netscape would have an opportunity to sue Microsoft in the U.S. court for its global conduct. It has the opportunity for treble damages and attorney's fees here, so it's not likely that it would want to then bring its own private action in the U.K. because it could get a lot of money.
Can it be just here the foreign non-competition?
Well, no. Maybe if it's only relating to conduct that's going on abroad, but probably not as well. You've got the example you gave, you got two U.S. companies and a lot of policies kind of set in Washington, I suspect. So you know, I don't know, but you know, I think, but it's, there's sort of a side point is the Intel AMD, the use of the commission, how there's been fighting between AMD and Intel at the commission, much the way that Charles just described, and they've been, AMD's been using the U.S. courts to do discovery, so they can then take it back and put it in to its submissions to the commission to explain why Intel's been violating Article 2. So that's sort of an interesting side of the question you're asking.
I think also just, and if you look at the local level, going to was it local court, I think it is reasonable to assume that there will be a bit of bias against the U.S. corporation suing a French company. And, I mean, so I think even if U.S. corporations are used to use that kind of power to solve their issues, we're not, and the judges are aware of that, and they will have that bias. That said, you know, I think when most corporations are going overseas, they play by the local rules, and at the end of the day, the treatment is not the same for Vivendi than for Microsoft, it's French courts, or Apple, God slam, I mean France, and it's
no national champion.
And I think there is clearly bias. I would not recommend to a U.S. corporation to sue. I think at the European level, you're much better off.
The commission.
Yeah, going to the commission.
frame a certain way to get there.
I had a case recently for an American corporation which was identified as a, it wasn't the biggest company in its field, but it was identified clearly as the leading thinker in its area with the latest developments and innovation. And they had a case which was kind of a Microsoft lookalike against a French dominant company. And the question was, you know, do we sue in the National Court of France? And I said, I don't think so. Or do we go to the European Commission? The difficulty with the European Commission is limited resources, post Big Bang, if you want, post enlargement, reluctant to take on new cases unless there was a very clear and very strategically important community interest involved. We went to the same case team that was handling the Microsoft case, who said, we have to say that you can't do anything. And I said, well, we've got the same kind of issues, but this time it's not against an American company, it's an American company against a European monopolist, and we think that we think that he'd be interested. So we sent them a briefing paper, and they phoned us up the next day and said, can you come this week? And they were very, very helpful. They said, we'll take this case, this is what we need to do, this is the evidence that we want to do. We can go through the advisory council, and in the end, the company's merged. And the French monopolist had no idea that that this was going on. But that's, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, the issue of the interplay with national politics and so on is a key issue. And I think it's one of the reasons Provini came to London. It's because we have specialist judges in a specialist court trained to deal with competition cases in the commercial context.
Anyway, we've gone over our time, so I'd like to thank all of you for sitting through this and participating. I'd like to thank very much Thomas and Charles for coming a long way to share some of your thoughts with us. And I'd also like to thank Charlotte for being our guide today and sort of making sure we made it here. So again, thanks very much.